Today is Tuesday, October 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. House of Representatives is scheduled to hear new testimony today in the impeachment inquiry against U.S. President Donald Trump. Also ahead,
the Islamic State is more of a decentralized, non-command-driven group that's inspired rather than directed.
And the future of the Islamic State group will be discussed, as well as Hong Kong tells pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong he can't run for office. Those stories and more are all next. The full House of Representatives will vote this week on the impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump, addressing the White House argument that the probe has been illegitimate. Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has scheduled a vote for Thursday, saying in a letter to fellow representatives that she wants to eliminate any doubt about the process. Joining us now on the phone to break things down is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So what can you tell us about this vote that's going to take place on Thursday?
Well, that's actually what everyone up here on the Hill has been attempting to find out this morning and into the afternoon, is that we actually don't have a text for that resolution yet, but we do know that it will go to markup, which is kind of a preliminary step towards the vote, tomorrow afternoon, and then hopefully we'll get that full House floor vote on Thursday. In the meantime, what I've been hearing from Democratic leadership is that they don't want this to be an impeachment vote. They don't want it to be seen as a proxy vote for how Democrats are going to vote on an actual full articles of impeachment on the House floor. They're emphasizing with me that this is really just a next step in laying out the process of the investigation.
Do they feel compelled to have this vote? I mean, this is something that the White House has been asking for a long time. But last Friday, there was a federal judge that ruled that what the Democrats were doing was, in fact, legal under the Constitution.
Being able to do this and being able to ask the Trump administration through court orders for documents for this impeachment investigation. So it was an interesting step here yesterday when we heard that this was going to happen, particularly since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had previously said that the House was fully within its rights under the U.S. Constitution to conduct an impeachment inquiry.
Catherine, we lost you at the beginning of that. What was the first part of your answer?
Sure. That, you know, the courts have recognized what the Democrats are doing. They're saying that the House does have the power to conduct an impeachment investigation without a formal floor vote. Now, that has happened in the past, but it's not listed anywhere in the Constitution. There's no rule that says that the House has to make that step.
We have about 30 seconds left. I want to get you to comment on what we know about Alexander Vindman. He's the military officer from the NSC that was testifying today. What can you share about his testimony?
That's right. It's very important testimony today on Capitol Hill. Vindman was actually on the call between U.S. President Donald Trump and the Ukrainian president, that famous call that triggered this impeachment inquiry up on Capitol Hill. So while we have the whistleblower complaint, that whistleblower complaint was second or third hand, and that's something the Republicans have used to attack the Democrats' impeachment inquiry. Now we're hearing about that call firsthand from someone who was there.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
Under Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's command, the Islamic State group became one of the most brutal armed forces in the world. U.S. President Donald Trump's confirmation of Baghdadi's death in a U.S. Special Forces operation inside Syria represents a serious blow to the terrorist group. President Trump also said on Tuesday the U.S. military had killed the person who was likely to have succeeded Baghdadi as a leader of the Islamic State militant group. David DeRoche is a counterterrorism expert at the U.S. National Defense University. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi about the outlook for IS after Baghdadi, especially in Africa.
Baghdadi was executing some control of the group, but he's really more of an inspirational leader. And the Islamic State is more of a decentralized, non-command-driven group that's inspired rather than directed. So the prospects for it as an insurgency are actually pretty good. It's going to take a sustained effort over a long period of time to eliminate the rest of the Daesh leadership, and because it's so decentralized, wherever there's a lack of governance or malgovernance throughout the Islamic world, we're likely to see a pop-up of Daesh activity.
Would Africa be the new battleground for ISIS future activities?
ISIS tends to take root in areas that have an Islamic population and that are poorly governed or just not governed at all. And so that describes large portions of Africa. So I think the future of ISIS actually is in Africa. The government institutions are generally not strong. The security forces are generally ineffective. And, you know, the population is certainly has the same grievances, maybe not on the same scale, that we saw with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So, yes, absolutely.
President Trump said the United States knows Baghdadi's successors. Does that mean it would be easy to track them down and achieve the ultimate goal of finishing off the ISIS group?
You know, it won't be easy, but it's certainly possible. ISIS is, as I said, decentralized. And the main group of ISIS in terms of direction and attacks and controls, things like the Bataclan attack and stuff like that, that organization will be relatively easy to take out compared to the second challenge, which is ISIS-inspired but not directed attacks like the Nice Bastille Day truck attack, the Pulse shooting in Orlando, Florida. Those are going to be much, much harder, and unfortunately, the message that inspired disaffected people like that, it's out there and it can't be taken back. So that's going to be an issue of governance rather than just assassinating people.
Defense Minister Mark Esper said it is difficult to defeat the ideology behind ISIS. What's the remedy then?
Well, that's a good question. So most of the people who are attracted to ISIS, particularly the non-directed supporters of ISIS, 125 years ago they would have been anarchists, and 70 years ago they would have been communists. These are people who are generally in a situation where they see themselves as being marginalized, where they look at the world dominant order and they think that it doesn't work for them. And so they say, what can I do to change the world? What can I do to change my life? And the only way to deal with that in the long term is the same way that Argentina dealt with their terrorism problem, which is to implement democratic reforms, to have a government that represents the interests of all their folks and that is truly participatory. And then citizens will find that they don't have to resort to violence. They can actually participate in government and see their needs addressed that way. And a large part of the world, unfortunately, is not there.
That was David DeRoche, a counterterrorism expert at the U.S. National Defense University, speaking to my VOA colleague, Mohammed El-Shanawi. Hong Kong on Tuesday disqualified pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong from taking part in upcoming district elections, a move likely to spark more discord in a city hit by 5 months of anti-government protests. Ryan Brooks from Reuters has that story.
On Tuesday, Wong confirmed the ban on the grounds that advocacy for Hong Kong's self-determination violates election law. He called the move political censorship.
Now, I become the only candidate banned from running in November's district council election. The decision to ban me from running office is clearly politically driven. The so-called reasons is judging subjectively on my intention to uphold basic law. But everyone would know that the true reason is my identity, Joshua Wong, is the crime in their mind.
Wong has not been a prominent figure in the last 5 months of sometimes violent protests, which are largely leaderless. However, he has a high profile abroad. Wong went on a tour to the U.S. and Germany this year, lobbying for overseas support for the protests. Beijing has said that it strongly disapproved of his meetings with foreign politicians. Chinese state media has called him a pro-independence leader, a claim he denies. Barring Wong from elections is likely to fuel further discord in Hong Kong. He urged protesters to take to the streets this weekend, which is expected to be filled with violent clashes. Long-running protests have taken a heavy toll on the city's economy. Earlier on Tuesday, Carrie Lam said she expected the city's economy to shrink this year and called the situation, quote, very grim.
That was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks, and you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the European Southern Observatory may help make the case for an asteroid to be reclassified as a dwarf planet. Called Hygieia, the object is the fourth largest in the asteroid belt, located between Mars and Jupiter. Using ESO's Very Large Telescope, the astronomers observed and imaged Hygieia at a high resolution to allow them to determine the object is spherical in shape. The astronomers say that Hygieia already met three of the four requirements to be classified as a dwarf planet. It orbits the Sun, it's not a moon, and unlike a regular planet, it's not the dominant object in its orbit. The fourth requirement is that the object has enough mass for its own gravity to pull it into a roughly spherical shape, which has now been determined by the astronomers' observations. If reclassified, Hygieia would be the smallest dwarf planet. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. President Sebastian Pinera faced new protests on Monday after he replaced eight cabinet members, a house cleaning aimed at taming the biggest political crisis since Chile's return to democracy in 1990. Reuters' Eve Johnson takes it from here.
A fresh bid to soothe public anger in Chile ended in chaos on Monday. In Santiago, protesters set a downtown shopping center on fire, leaving firefighters scrambling to put out the blaze. Demonstrators hit the streets by the thousands, facing off against security forces and water cannons. Earlier in the day, President Sebastián Piñera had announced a big government reshuffle. He replaced eight cabinet ministers, including his finance and interior ministers.
This is not the same Chile from a few weeks ago. Chile has changed, and the government must change with it to confront these new challenges and these new times.
For years, Chile has boasted one of the most stable and prosperous economies in Latin America. But the rising cost of living and inequality has sparked public anger. Last week, protests spilled onto the streets and quickly spun out of control, leaving at least 17 people dead and thousands arrested. Piñera has already pledged a raft of reforms, like boosting the minimum wage and pensions, and lowering the price of things like medicine and public transportation. But a recent poll found most Chileans still feel that he's not doing enough. And going by the mood on the streets, Chile's biggest political crisis in decades isn't over yet.
And that was Eve Johnson from Reuters News. As hundreds of Iraqi protesters are hunkered down in Baghdad's central Tahrir Square, and in other provinces, analysts say the country is facing a precarious moment, one which bold and concrete action is needed from the government. But can and will Iraq's leadership deliver? A renewed wave of anti-government demonstrations has been seen to kill at least 250 individuals and wound more than 4,000 this month. Teachers and lawyers' unions, even planning ministry employees, are joining the young protesters. Dale Gavlek has that story.
Analysts say that nobody, be it Iraq's leaders or the protesters, know where the demonstrations will go. The protests are leaderless, without an organizational structure, and are not unified. But the desperate groupings of the young jobless, activist intellectuals, or poor Shiites are clearly demanding an end to widespread corruption, unemployment, the lack of public services like electricity, and cronyism engulfing Iraq. "We are here to bring down the whole government, to weed them all out," one protester told the French AFP news agency. Renaud Mansour at Chatham House in London believes the protests won't die out and also the status quo won't continue.
"I think that kind of muddling through is no longer viable. The question becomes, to what extent will the government have reforms that are meaningful rather than the same reforms that we've seen for the last 2 years, changing cabinet ministers, promising electoral law reform, all of that stuff? Or will there be some quite serious structural changes, a replacement of certain leaders, the prime minister, another election? Something more scary than that is if armed groups take to the streets to use the protest movement to settle their own scores, as we saw last Friday, it could turn violent as well."
Analyst Omar El-Nadawi points to the Iraqi government's shortcomings in the areas of establishing good governance, combating corruption, and creating an inclusive meritocracy with equal opportunity for marginalized groups. He says this failure is inseparable from the country's deepening entanglement in the rising tension with Iran. Renaud Mansour says the political elite can no longer use the sectarian card, as protesters are turning against leaders and demand an end to Iranian interference in the country.
They're rejecting their own leaders because one of the main slogans they say is, in the name of religion, they robbed us. And linked to that is this kind of anti-Iranian sentiment, because they view Iran as almost an occupying force. The same kind of sentiment that they would have had against the Americans, they have against Iranians now, because they view Iran as effectively deciding who is in government, who is not in government, who has power, who doesn't have power. One of the main slogans has been Iran out, out.
Unlike past protests, these have been met with escalating force from the security apparatus using live ammunition. Activists are also seething over a probe absolving the authorities of responsibility for the killing of scores of protesters. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is pushing for another election, AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Johnson will, for a fourth time, ask Parliament to approve an early election after lawmakers rejected his latest bid amid concerns about the government's Brexit plans. The government will now introduce a short bill calling for an election on December the 12th. This one would require a simple majority to be passed. Now, to win support from opposition parties, Johnson says he will delay further debate on the EU bill, dubbed the WAB, until after the election. Two small opposition parties, which had proposed an earlier election date to block Brexit, may support this one. Charles de Ledesma, London.
And British opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn told his top team of policy advisers that the party's condition for supporting a new election had been met and that they will now launch the most ambitious and radical election campaign. Staying in Britain, Vietnam is trying to speed up the identification of people found dead in the back of a truck near London last week, some of whom are thought to be Vietnamese. A UK court heard on Monday that a global ring had been involved in smuggling the group. The truck's driver is facing charges of manslaughter and people trafficking. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Dr. George Belitsos, chairman of the board of the Iowa Network Against Human Slavery, based in Ames, Iowa. Belitsos recently toured Europe, Scandinavia, and China on a fact-finding mission. Ira began their conversation by asking Belitsos what impressed him most.
In United Kingdom, I was very impressed by their efforts. I was impressed by what Theresa May had done while she was heading the government, and she got through several anti-slavery, anti-trafficking bills and funding for the victims of trafficking, the survivors. And they have a network of shelters and rehabilitation programs for the survivors. They're prosecuting the cases. They're investigating. They're really going hard at fighting trafficking in their own country and people being brought in to be labor trafficked or sex trafficked from other countries. And they have a long way to go, as we do in this whole across the globe. This heinous worldwide crime is growing very fast, and the more vulnerable people that get caught in the net of these traffickers, they are going to exploit them, and they are gaining a lot of money off of the labor and off the bodies of these victims.
What is the about percentage of how many of those being trafficked are from Asian countries?
In the UK, I think it's probably about 10%.
All right.
That's a guess. They have a lot of trafficking going on because, you know, their borders have been pretty open, and that's one of the reasons they're trying to protect their borders with Brexit. But I do know that they do have a lot of Asian people being trafficked. I'd say it's 1 out of 10 at least.
Can you trace for me what might be the path of either a Vietnamese or Chinese person who's being trafficked to the UK?
So, and someone being trafficked in the UK from China, it could be, I would say, for labor and also sex trafficking in these massage businesses. Sometimes they're also being trafficked for labor in places like nail salons. The women that are coming in they're not being told, honestly, that they are going to be trafficked or slaves. They are being, these are usually girls or even some men from a very rural, very poor, very uneducated parts of China, and being promised jobs and good income, and they're going to pay their transportation, and they're going to they make all of these promises of helping them upgrade their lives, and just the opposite happens. They smuggle the people into the country, and they get there, and they are told that they have to pay an exorbitant amount for their transportation and for their housing, and before they know it, they're working in these salons or in these businesses that where they're really not getting paid anything. They're getting their minimum amount of food and clothing, and they don't speak English. They don't have any ability to reach out and ask for help. They are slaves.
And that was Dr. George Blitzos, chairman of the board of the Iowa Network Against Human Slavery, speaking to VOA Asia's Ira Melman. An Australian-led study claims to have pinpointed the birthplace of modern humans to a region south of the Zambezi River in southern Africa. Scientists have used DNA as well as climate and geological data to track our evolution back 200,000 years to what is now a region that covers parts of Botswana, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. However, as Phil Mercer reports, other experts think there are flaws in the research, which is published in the journal Nature.
Scientists in Australia believe they've rewritten human history. They say our ancestral homeland was near a giant lake in southern Africa. Researchers have traced an ancient family tree using about 1,200 samples of mitochondrial DNA, which are passed from a mother to her child. The research team says this has allowed them to map out the oldest known maternal line of humans alive today. By combining genetics with geology and climate computer model simulations, the researchers have created an impression of what the African continent might have been like 200,000 years ago. Professor Vanessa Hayes is at Australia's Garvan Institute of Medical Research.
We could trace with our DNA back to this region called Makhali Makhali, but then when we overlaid the geographic data plus the climate data, it pinpointed that this must have been the region because it was like an oasis in this huge desert, which allowed anatomically modern humans to not only survive but to thrive.
After staying there for 70,000 years, people began to move out when a changing climate created fertile green corridors, paving the way for future migrations away from Africa. However, other experts doubt that the human story can be reconstructed from this type of genetic analysis alone. Previous studies, which have analysed fossils, have suggested our origins lie in eastern Africa. There is the possibility that modern humans evolved at similar times in different places before interbreeding. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, engineer Charleston Mock, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for listening today. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.